if you imagine that there is a drug out there that, you know, increases your metabolism, causes weight loss, damps down inflammation, you know, doesn't cause allergies, and improves your quality of life and you live longer, you know, imagine that drug, that sort of elixir of life, it exists and it's called food. But the problem is that food can also act the other way. You know, the door swings both ways and it can cause obesity. It can cause diabetes, blood pressure, cancers, misery, and an early death.
Dr. Andrew Jenkinson is part of an expert team developing advances in gastrointestinal surgery at University College Hospital. He's here to explain how we can eat and still lose weight. I'm Liz Earle. Welcome to the Liz Earle Wellbeing Show. This is the podcast helping us all have a better second half. And as you know, it's my mission to find ways for all of us to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. So we are reaching the end of January, and research suggests that by this point, you're likely to have given up the quick fix fad diet. But if your goal is to lose weight, you might want to ditch the traditional ideas you've had about the best way to do that anyway, and focus on things like habit creation, mental reprogramming, and understanding your hormones instead. Andrew Jenkinson is a consultant surgeon with a special interest in advanced keyhole surgery. We've spoken here before, you may well recognise his voice, and he's an expert on stomachs and bowels and has written a vital book called How to Eat and Still Lose Weight. So let's unpack the fascinating relationship between the brain and the body, as well as the hormonal imbalances that are key to sustainable weight loss. And by the way, there is no willpower required for this diet.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Andrew, why are you so passionate about the food we put into our bodies? And what angle are you coming at this from as a surgeon?
Well, thanks for the invitation to be here, Liz. It's always a pleasure. I sort of had zero interest in dieting and weight regulation when I was sort of younger and even training as a surgeon. But when I qualified as a bariatric or weight loss surgeon, my clinics became full of people who really, really struggled with their weight, you know, took over their lives, constantly dieting. And they all sort of said the same sort of things. So things like, yeah, I can lose weight on a low-calorie diet, but I always put it back on. I think I've got a low metabolism, and I think it might be in the genes. So all of these things got me thinking, you know, they're not sort of common knowledge, but everyone, all the patients were trying to tell me the same thing. So I just got sort of slightly inspired to look into weight regulation and metabolism in much more detail. And that, you know, was the inspiration for the first book, Why We Eat Too Much, which really laid out how food affects our hormones rather than just calories and nutrients. But the feedback from that book was, this is really, really good. Many people did lose a lot of weight and kept it off, but other people really had difficulty, you know, cracking their old bad habits. So this is where the second book's come in, which looks at, you know, quite a lot of the new science around the brain and habits and reward pathways. And I think sort of it unpicks that in such a way that when you understand it, it just becomes much easier to change not only habits, but your diet, and then just reset your weight, basically.
Mm. Fascinating. I mean, I remember well our first conversation. We were talking about why we eat, you know, the first book, that relationship between food and our bodies, and talking about these different hormones that come into play, ghrelin and leptin, for example. But you're right, we didn't necessarily talk about how our brains are constantly seeking the easiest and most pleasurable path. And that's obviously often at the detriment to our health. So when you were focusing now on the new book, what was really the importance then of this brain-body connection, and how do we tap into that?
Well, you know, the interesting story was Penguin kept pestering me to write another book, and I said, look, I don't have any new ideas. And then I was doing one of my clinics in the UAE with my friend Sama, who's my translator. He's a Jordanian man. And we'd been seeing patients, you know, throughout the day, people who wanted dietary advice or bariatric surgery operations like sleeve or band, or just the injection treatment. And then we were sort of having a coffee in the evening, me and Sam were sitting outside. And Sam is a pretty slim guy. He's in his 40s. And he said, you know, Dr. Andrew, I used to suffer with obesity as well. I used to be 125 kilograms and he was now, you know, 75 kilograms.
Wow.
And he had managed to maintain that weight loss for 10 years. And I was just totally intrigued. Basically, what he was doing was pretty much what the advice was from my first book, Why We Eat Too Much. So basically, you know, cut down on carbs, you know, avoid sugar and, you know, processed foods, eat fish, meat and vegetables and fresh fruits and not snack too much. So he had sort of done that, but he'd had a lot of difficulty doing it. And the whole inspiration for this book came about by the fact that through learning about weight loss, and he said, it's like learning to play a guitar, for instance, you're going to make mistakes, you know, you're going to go off the rails, you're going to get like really sort of frustrated. But the more you try, the better you'll get at weight loss, the more dietary efforts you have.
Mm.
Eventually, he'd come to a point where his whole brain was sort of changed in that he developed a real aversion to sugar and processed foods. And, you know, he said to me, you know, if a hamburger, fast food hamburger, was the last thing on earth to eat, he wouldn't eat it.
Interesting. So, yeah.
The inspiration was that, you know, he wasn't using willpower anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need willpower. His mind had been changed. And it's sort of a little bit like, I'm sure you've heard of the Alan Carr's method of giving up smoking.
Yes.
Once you know, once you really, really grasp what nicotine does for you, how it sort of hooks you, and, you know, what it can do, what it does to your body, and the whole sort of environment around it without advertising and acceptance in society, especially if few years ago, once you know that and have that knowledge, you become a different person. And it's almost you finish that book and the idea is you're already a non-smoker. So, you know, the inspiration for this book was, let's put all the information out there, you know, not only about what food does to our hormones, but also how it really hooks us and changes our habits. And once we understand that, you know, it's so much easier to change.
Mm. So really what I'm kind of distilling from this is a shift in mentality before anything else is kind of the first and the most important step in moving towards weight loss.
Yeah, I mean, there's a section in the book about our identity, i.e. who we are. And I think one of the parts says, imagine you're in a room with, you know, the childhood yourself, the adolescent you, the young adult you, the mature adult you, and the elderly you. Are you all the same people? Have you got the same identity? And the answer is no, you're totally different people. Our identities are formed by, they're constantly changing by our sort of interaction and knowledge of the world. So, for instance, if you read a book and, you know, educate yourself about exactly what the food environment does, not only to your body, but to your brain, you become a different person, your identity changes slightly, and then you're not as reliant on willpower. You know, you understand what's going on, you grasp it. So, yeah, it is a little bit like you just educate yourself to such an extent that it willpower is no longer a big issue.
No, I've never actually thought of it in that specific way, but over the years, I've definitely changed how I eat, and I eat a lot more protein, very little sugar, virtually nothing out of a packet. And I do that because, not necessarily for weight loss, although that's kind of been a helpful side effect, but because I want to build a stronger body. I want to have more muscle mass. I want my brain to function better as I age. I want to be clearer headed. And you're right. I've kind of lost my sweet tooth and that urge to snack because my brain is just no longer telling me that that's a good thing. So I'm seeing it from not from a calorific restriction, but a kind of a health gain, which is a total switch, isn't it, of how we perceive it in our brain.
Yeah. I mean, Samo said to me when he was explaining all the various different things he'd done to, you know, totally reset his weight by 50 kilograms, the most difficult thing was giving up sugar. And he spent 40 days, you know, he said he could have cried. His friends were sort of chiding him and offering him sweets and things. And he said he could have banged his head against the wall. But he said after 40 days, it just left him. The craving just left him. It never came back. But, you know, one of the interesting things to think about is if you imagine that there is a drug out there that, you know, increases your metabolism, causes weight loss, damps down inflammation, you know, doesn't cause allergies, and improves your quality of life and you live longer, you know. Imagine that drug, that sort of elixir of life, it exists and it's called food. But the problem is that food can also act the other way. You know, the door swings both ways and it can cause obesity, it can cause diabetes, blood pressure, cancers, misery, and an early death. So we need to start thinking about food, not just in terms of calories, which we obviously need to survive and move around and, you know, and also not just about nutrients, which obviously our body needs, so our vitamins and minerals and things like that, but also we need to think about food in what it does to us as a drug. And an example would be, for instance, when you drink a cup of coffee, that's like a natural drug from plants that's going to, you know, wake you up, you know, increase your blood pressure, increase your metabolism, maybe make you a little bit anxious. This is a typical example of a plant drug. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all the food we eat, whether it be processed or fresh, has various different effects on our hormonal system and our brains and minds. And we need to sort of start really thinking about food as a drug, as well as calories and nutrients.
Mm.
For instance, you know, there is a very important hormone called leptin, which we sort of discussed in the first book. And you can just sort of think of it as our weight control hormone. So it just works. When it's functioning, it works to naturally control your weight. And this weight control hormone is working absolutely perfectly in all wild animals. They don't suddenly develop obesity, you know, in response to having quite a lot of food. They don't become obese. But this weight control hormone can be blocked by various different, you know, sort of drug elements in our foods. And we all know that sugar and refined carbohydrates cause weight loss, and they cause it by increasing insulin, which then blocks that weight control hormone. So suddenly you go to a situation where your weight was under control sort of seamlessly and naturally to it being out of control. And a lot of my patients describe this really quite scary feeling of their weight not being under their own control or natural control anymore, and just wanting to go up. They develop a voracious appetite, and, you know, it's scary for them. And that's because the food that they're eating is blocking their weight control.
Is blocking it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the time, I think eating just turns into a kind of habitual, almost mindless behavior. I mean, talking about drugs and hormones and neurochemicals, talk to me about where dopamine fits into these loops and how we can start to create better habits around eating.
Yes, there is a lot of new and emerging understanding of brain science, including reward pathways, and the most understood ones are the ones that involve the dopamine reward. We actually have quite vulnerable brains. You know, we're wired to survive, and one of those things is to seek high calorie, you know, sweet foods. Once we've had an experience of eating that particular type of food, and it tends to be when we're very young and given sweets and things as a treat, we will never forget that. That feeling of reward, dopamine, that's released when we ate that is remembered.
Yeah.
And our brains will seek out cues from anywhere in the environment where that food and that reward might still be available, and we'll go after it. And so our brains are pretty vulnerable, and the food industry are very much aware how our brains yes. work, and they've manufactured, you know, artificial but extremely, you know, hedonic and pleasurable yeah. foods.
Yeah, I mean, do you see that that's deliberate?
Yes,
I mean,
yeah, because
it's,
you know,
just the sort of pursuit of profit pathway.
Yes, I mean, these foods are always sort of tested on, you know, hundreds of different variants on thousands of volunteers, and they'll come up with like some perfect color, taste, you know, crunch, you know, mouthfeel.
That you just want to keep going back to, yeah.
And on the back of that, they'll then, you know, introduce brightly colored logos and just reminders of this is where the food is, this is where you can get it. And we are surrounded by, you know, food advertising 24/7. So once you become aware of, you know, what the environment is like, how, you know, the food industry has manufactured fantastic tasting foods, but, you know, foods that are quite dangerous to us, the penny starts to drop that, you know, things are stacked a little bit against us, but actually it's quite easy to understand that, you know, our vulnerable brain is being a little bit hijacked by, you know, industry.
That is really interesting, isn't it? When you think about the environmental or the lifestyle cues or triggers that are out there, you know, working away to keep us in unhealthy eating patterns deliberately. And when you spot it and see it, it's kind of quite hard to unsee it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's quite a good point, Liz. It's it really is. And if you go down the high street, or if you just switch on the TV or put on your smartphone, we're constantly bombarded by adverts for, you know, snacks and foods that are really, really, you know, probably taste quite good, you know, but they're not very good for our bodies. And when you understand, you know, exactly what's in these foods, so lots of vegetables, sugars, flavorings, colorings, artificial, you know, things that are not food at all, you know, not only causing that blockage of your weight control hormone, but, you know, pro-inflammatory conditions, yeah. allergies, you know, all of these things. Once you understand that's the food that they're marketing,
yes.
and they're marketing it because it looks great and it tastes great, but actually they're working on your vulnerable brain, and, you know, this type of food actually is really, really bad for you.
Yeah.
Then with that understanding, it's a little bit easier to
yes.
change habits. And the book then goes into, you know, understanding habits and how they can be changed as well.
I mean, I think a lot of us, our habits may have changed recently. I mean, I think, can we touch on lockdown weight here? You know, we went through a huge change then in terms of environment and habit and lifestyle. And presumably that had a detrimental knock-on effect in terms of weight and the habits we might have gotten ourselves into. I mean, I remember, you know, trying to buy food and my greengrocer and my butcher were shut, but I could go into a McDonald's or I could order a pizza. I mean, the whole thing was just so totally skewed. And presumably, you know, we were locked down for far too long and, you know, too many people only had bad food choices available to them. And it doesn't take long, does it, for a healthy habit, you know, to go out of the window and be replaced by something, you know, far more disastrous for our health.
Yeah, so there's a chapter in the book which starts on, you know, the consequences of lockdown and describes a pretty negative effect, you know, like the fact that I think a third of people lost control of their weight. They put on a considerable amount of weight.
A third?
Yeah, put on a lot of weight.
Staggering. That is staggering.
For instance, the gyms were closed as well.
Well, exactly.
They?
And we weren't allowed to go outside for like more than 20 minutes. I mean, how bizarre is that?
We weren't really allowed
to
walk the dog properly.
Yeah. Just go out and breathe fresh air.
You know, but the point of that chapter is, you know, actually lockdown was terrible. And it was caused by this forcible change in our habits, which changed, you know, our weight and our health. But actually, the good news is, you know, once you understand that, you know, those habits were changed by lockdown, we can change habits back
change
towards
back.
Healthier ones.
Yeah.
But you just need to know how to. And it's all about, you know, friction of how easy
I mean, I was going to ask you about this, a slightly contentious one perhaps, or maybe it's just semantics, but, you know, what's your take on whether we can be addicted to food?
Yeah, so I think we are. I mean, obviously the reward pathways, for instance, sugary type foods, we do get a great reward from it. It makes us happier, sort of wakes us up a little bit. So unless you've given up sugar, if you still, you know, eat sugar now and again, you will get a craving for it at particular times. And it might just be a particular time of day when your brain is just used to having that reward. Maybe when you're walking along the high street and you see an advert for something, or, you know, something reminds you when you open your phone or whatever. That's when you get that, you know, that cue,
yeah.
You know,
the
reminder that the reward is there.
It's
hard. That's when the craving starts. And that's what addiction is, I think.
So, I mean, for me, it's putting fuel in the car, and then I go to pay in the petrol station and you're queuing. And as you queue, there is this huge aisle of really tasty snacks and chocolate and all the rest of it. And you just think, oh, maybe I'll just pick up one of those. And I have to literally physically turn my body and look the other way and just think, this is all junk. It's deliberate marketing. I'm not going to go for it. They're just, you think of them as like drug pushers. You know, I'm just a whole load of push drug dealers just standing along the side of the road waiting for me to come along and feed my addiction. Well, I'm sorry, it's just not happening. I mean, occasionally I'll, you know, pick up something, but 9 times out of 10, I really do. And I say, I see you, I call you out, I'm not having it.
Yeah, so that's, so you have some insight into the fact that, you know, you do have a normal human vulnerable brain, you have insight into that cue and that craving, but you say no. One of the things in the book that we sort of look into a little bit is, you know, obviously the reward pathway system is a little bit, it does act like a drug. So those sweets in the aisle at the petrol station, they're drugs. Mm-hmm. Okay. You're much more likely to cave in and pick them up if you're very stressed.
Right. Yes.
Just like you might, if you're a smoker,
yeah.
Have a cigarette.
Or an alcohol,
or if you
yeah.
Like a drink, sure. You know, have a glass of wine.
Yeah.
So there are a number of techniques in the book. It's called De-Stress Toolkit or something, mm-hmm. where there's breathing exercises, there's, you know, different types of meditation, there's touch and tapping techniques, which if you find that there is like one or two of them that actually really suit you, and you can start to control your stress levels without resorting to drugs, whether it be, you know, a Kit Kat or a glass of wine,
mm-hmm.
it just makes it easier to resist those cravings and temptations. Mm. The other thing in the book that it goes over is this thing called crave surfing. So if you find that, you know, you've got this craving for, I don't know, some bad food or whatever, by becoming, you know, very consciously aware of the strength of that craving, in a way it becomes easier to withstand it.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes conscious, and you can feel the crave, the strength of the crave increasing. And then you'll feel the strength of the wave decreasing. It's called crave surfing.
Right.
And you will go over waves. It will get worse, you know, more difficult and then easier. And as you go along, those waves will become less, less severe. You know, that's one way of getting through these early craves.
Right.
But, you know, if you give something up for long enough, then those craves won't be as pronounced.
I mean, you obviously run a bariatric surgery unit at University College London Hospital. Why are people ending up coming to you? You know, what sort of journeys will they have been on beforehand? Presumably, you see quite hardcore cases where people have tried so many things before you finally end up with a bariatric surgeon.
Yeah, so everyone has tried, you know, decades of dieting with the usual sort of advice from doctors and dietitians, you know, count your calories. Watch out for fat, which is the most terrible advice ever. You know, natural saturated fat is really, really good for you.
It's really good for you. Artificial. I'm so thrilled you said that because, yeah, you know, sugar is the baddie, fat is the hero.
Well, you know, natural saturated fat is the hero, but, you know, we get confused because polyunsaturated fatty acids, so vegetable oils, which we're told are healthy, are almost like a metabolic poison for us, which is explained in the first book, but also we go over that, you know, the omega-3-6 ratio thing and the fact that this really healthy anti-inflammatory helps insulin work. Fatty acid omega-3 is basically washed out of our system by vegetable oils and fast foods and processed foods.
Yeah.
And that means that our insulin doesn't work properly. We become a different person, you know, and it's just much more easy for our bodies to want to put weight on because, you know, we need more insulin, so that weight loss hormone is blocked. Et cetera.
So fascinating. I love that. Bariatric surgeon saying, you know, eat more saturated fat, you know, focus on on omega-3s
and
avoid seed oils.
Is,
yeah, go on.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is, and this is a bit controversial, but I think it's true, you know, I've got this big theory that the omega-3-6 profile, so the amount of omega-3, which is in natural fresh foods, versus the amount of omega-6, which is in all processed foods. There's like there's a big disparity. So if you want to even it out, as far as meat is concerned, you need to eat meat that's grass-fed. So
absolutely.
And not grain-fed, because grains are the, you know, the seeds, they've got a load of omega-6 in, so you're, then you're eating.
So you get seed oil in your meat because the animal has eaten seeds. Absolutely.
So grass-fed cow, beef and lamb is better than, controversial, chicken, which are always fed a load of grains. That's all they're fed on. They're massively high in omega-6. And pork, you know.
That's
these
so
things,
interesting.
We're told avoid red meat, you know, but actually chicken is, okay, it's lean, but there's no problem with fat, with saturated fat. So we've got a lot, there's a lot of things that
there's
are wrong
a long,
with
a lot of catching up, actually, because, you know, obviously we're told to now eat more protein. And when you look at high sources of protein, you know, chicken comes out pretty much, you know, one of the top on the protein charts, and it's relatively affordable. I mean, certainly compared to grass-fed beef. And, you know, you get industrialized chicken, you know, pretty much everywhere you look. And that actually, that point hasn't been made to me before, that it will be higher in omega-6s. That's really fascinating.
It's massively high in omega-6 if you look it up. But yeah, we sort of, this sort of omega-3-6 hypothesis, which, you know, when you look at the, you know, epidemiology around the world, people who consume Western foods with lots of these oils in develop problems with inflammation and obesity. And it came about when we were told to avoid saturated fats. And we went into seed oils instead. You know, this is where the problem started. And it's backed up when you look into the nuances of what seed oil does do to us, so inflammation and problems with insulin signaling.
Fascinating.
It's something that is still not really understood by or accepted by most people, but I think it's really important.
Yeah.
The other thing
it.
About that is, you know, you need to change the way you eat as far as those oils are concerned for about a year for it to change your body. It takes ages. But once your body is changed, you do have a totally different body. Your metabolism is better. You know, you can protect your weight much, much easier.
Fascinating.
And the great thing is, you know, fish obviously is the best for omega-3.
Yeah, oily fish. Well, let's pause for a moment here. When we come back, I really want to dig into hormones, and particularly the hunger hormones and options for surgery, and, you know, also whether some people are always just going to carry a little more weight perhaps than others.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, let's just kick off this second half with just a little bit of practicalities about surgery, because obviously, you know, you spend your working life as a surgeon, and we've talked about, you know, when people come to see you. Can you just sort of briefly explain bariatric surgery? Is it something as simple as making a smaller stomach so there's less room for food, or is there a little bit more complex than that?
It's a little bit more complex than that. Basically, the surgery, if it's done, you know, appropriately in well-selected patients, is life-changing. Mm. We've all seen celebrities that have suspiciously lost a lot of weight, and they seem to be a different people, you know, and they say they've done it by diets. It's a load of rubbish. If you lost 40, 50 kilograms, unless you're my mate, Sama, which was very, very unusual, it's probable that you've had one of the two main operations, which is either a gastric bypass or a sleeve gastrectomy. So the sleeve operation is actually 2/3 to 3/4 of your stomach are actually removed. It goes from, you know, the size of a melon to the size of a banana. And the gastric bypass, you know, the stomach's not removed, but it's bypassed. So, you know, you have a little residual egg-sized stomach, which then sort of the food then drains into the intestine. Both of these operations, you know, traditionally we thought it's because people are losing weight because the stomach is smaller and you can't eat as much. But actually we now know for both of the operations profoundly change the signaling between the stomach and intestines, those hormones that are produced from that area that, you know, swim around in our bloodstream and hit our hypothalamus in the brain, which is the weight control center. It's the crucial part of the brain that controls our weight. And we know that after these operations, the various different hormones that, you know, produce appetite and satiety are totally switched around. Weight loss is sort of seamless. You don't really feel very hungry. You feel as if your body wants to lose 40 kilograms. It doesn't seem like a chore or an effort. So, for instance, in both the operations, that this hormone called GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1, increases profoundly. And this damps down your appetite, but also improves the way your insulin functions. So all of a sudden, you don't need as much insulin. As we know from earlier on in our conversation, insulin blocks the weight control hormone. So suddenly the weight control hormone it's visible again to the hypothalamus. Mm-hmm. And the GLP-1 hormone that goes up really, really significantly in this type of surgery is the hormone that's now been copied and it forms the part of the, you know, the Ozempic,
right.
Wegovy,
yes,
semaglutide, Mounjaro type drugs that are ultra popular these days. Mm-hmm. So they mimic part of the effect of the bariatric surgery on the hypothalamus. So they're basically an analog or a copy of these hormones that work to block appetite.
So like having bariatric surgery, but without it. Are we talking about leptin here?
No, that's a different thing. So leptin is that weight control hormone.
Right.
But, you know, if you have either the surgery.
Yes.
Or to a lesser extent, it's less effective, but it's still effective, the injection treatment. Mm. Both of those treatments decrease the amount of insulin that you need, and that releases the weight control hormone leptin to be seen by the hypothalamus.
Right. Yep.
And that's one of the ways that, you know, you lose weight.
Are there other ways that we can increase leptin? I mean, leptin, obviously, we want to increase it. We want to decrease ghrelin. But there's no way that I'm going to inject myself with some sort of relatively new drug compound. I mean, we don't know what the long-term side effects of that are, do we?
No, totally. Well, I mean, we know that when you come off it, you put the weight back on.
No. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
what's the point of that?
It's a perfect drug
because it gets you hooked into it and then you've got to use it for life. My gosh.
And it's quite expensive, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially in America.
Wow.
So to release leptin, to stop leptin being blocked, you know, you need to understand why it's being blocked. So one is that your insulin levels are too high, and that's because your diet might have too much sugar, might have too much refined carbohydrates and processed foods. Mm-hmm. You might be snacking too much between meals. Also, going back to that omega 3 and 6 thing, if your body is infused with, you know, vegetable oil type omega 6, it's going to affect your insulin signaling. You need more insulin. And again, that's going to cause leptin, the weight control hormone, to be blocked. So by changing your diet away from sugar, away from refined carbohydrates, and away from, you know, seed oils and fast foods and processed foods, after a while, you know, leptin will be released and you will seamlessly lose weight.
Seamlessly lose weight. Okay, so seamlessly lose weight with no seed oils, so we get better insulin signaling, no sugar, so, you know, cutting the carbs out. And what about things like taking omega-3s? You know, we'd obviously talk about eating fish, but what about like an omega-3 supplement? Would that be a useful thing?
I don't think it does any harm. On balance, you know, if you cut omega-6 from your foods, it's just as good. But yeah, omega-3 is it doesn't do any harm taking omega-3 supplements. I recently tried to get back into cod liver oil, but I couldn't tolerate it. It's like some people like it, but they can't do it.
Yeah, and actually I've also seen some slightly worrying studies on fish liver oil, because obviously liver is an organ where a lot of toxic waste matter can be accumulated. And actually, if you are going to have a fish oil supplement, you know, the data I looked at said you're better off eating supplements that have been made by the flesh, the oily flesh of the fish, or krill, for example, rather than cod liver.
Well, you know, like do what the Japanese do, you know, just actually, you can buy your salmon, you don't have to, you know, and just cut it up, have it sashimi. And think about having seaweed. Seaweed's such a good food, full of omega-3.
Yes, very good. And even vegans can have that, which is very good. I mean, let's talk about the types of food then that we're eating. This is where the debate about why processed foods are quite so bad for us comes in, isn't it? You know, they're already high in calories. then we eat them even more because they're just so delicious, and that's they're made to be, you know, repeat bought and eaten all the time. So we are eating more calories overall, but then presumably, you know, with all the omega-6s and the sugars and everything, that's destroying our leptin. And that's actually what's having more of an effect in terms of weight gain, not necessarily the level of calories that we're eating.
That's correct. So, I mean, there's another misunderstanding. So basically, when that weight control hormone leptin is working, you can actually overeat and your metabolism will just adapt to overeating. So basically, metabolism, just so let me explain, basal metabolism, this is the amount of energy you use before you start moving.
Mm.
And it happens to be about 70% of what we use in total. You can imagine us a little bit like a dimmer switch. We can turn our metabolism up to bright or down to dim. When we overeat, if our weight control hormone leptin is working, our body will automatically increase the amount of metabolism that we're burning off, so it can easily take away 200-400 kilocalories just overnight, you know, while we're sleeping.
Mm.
And the same thing happens when we, you know, go on a diet. If our weight control hormone is working, it's just going to reduce that. So when we decrease the calories through our diet, it will just turn that dimmer switch down.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, there's no weight loss. Your body is adapted to the diet. So the thing that actually changes our weight up or down permanently is the effect on that weight control mechanism, the leptin mechanism. Again, going back to the particular types of food that affect it. And we know it's sugar, refined carbohydrates, vegetable oils. And there's another one in there that we put in the book, fructose, which is a type of sugar, mm-hmm. particularly in fruits. Although in the amounts that we would eat from fresh fruits, it doesn't affect us at all, but it actually does in very high amounts found in, you know, lots of processed foods. And if you drink a lot of fructose type drinks, fruit juices and things like this, that can trigger a cellular mechanism, which again stimulates weight gain.
Right.
So these things, sugar, refined carbohydrates, vegetable oils and fructose, tend to be, you know, contained in processed foods, are things that, you know, will, it's not the calories, it's, you know, the effect that these hormones have as far as almost like a drug is concerned.
Interesting. So the fructose point, I've seen sort of diet drinks, or not, I don't think they're labeled as diet, they're sort of labeled as light, containing fructose, whether they're using it because it's lower in calories or people think that it's a little bit healthier.
It's because it's sweeter.
So you need less of it. So would you actually say no, anything that has fructose in it actually is not going to be a healthy choice when it comes to leptin?
No, so that's a slightly different mechanism. So the fructose mechanism is a direct mechanism on the cell, which causes, you know, a weight gain, almost like a hibernation weight gain response at very high doses in humans. So that's different to the blockage of leptin. I think if you look at, you know, if you're drinking something which has got added whatever in, you know, probably it's not great. And the other thing about fructose, obviously, you know, half of sugar is fructose. So sugar is half fructose, half glucose. So, you know, we can try and look out for fructose and avoid fructose containing things. But also if we have sugar, then we're still taking a load of it.
And I know that, you know, particularly in America, I mean, and it's reaching over here as well, there's a lot of high fructose corn syrup that's used. Mm-hmm. And the whole sort of corn syrup, because it's such a cheap ingredient, sort of a byproduct of, you know, making seed oil, for example. So you've got two baddies, haven't you, that come out of one nice plant. You know, you've got the omega-6 seed oil, and then you've got the corn syrup that comes out that's used as a sweetener. I mean,
it's amazing what you can do. Yeah.
Yeah. And just think, you know, they are very cheap, very commercial, high intensity, you know, high yield crops that are grown, you know, monocultures with huge amounts of glyphosate and pesticide and all the rest of it. And I mean, hopefully.
This is what most people eat. Yes.
And that's the mainstay.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was in the supermarket recently and just having a look around, and I was just shocked, actually. You go down the aisle and there was sort of two entire aisles of cakes and biscuits and, you know, Mr. Kipling this and Deliciously Dreamy that. And, you know, it was just shocking when you start to see the amount of sugar per 100 grams on each pack. And they were all sold as treats, as specials, and a lot of them had money off. You know, they were buying, you know, buy three for the price of two and special discounts. And then you've got this tiny little fresh fruit and veg aisle. with
the first thing you come across, you put a bit of that in your basket and feel good about yourself.
And then think, and then great,
you're sort
I'll
of
go
like
and...
at the mercy of your vulnerable human brain.
Yeah.
So my advice would be, you know, supermarkets are really dangerous. You know, we do crave these things. Mm-hmm. It's much better. And these days we can get food deliveries.
Yeah, do it online.
Or we can just go. I mean, if we're not in a little village where we've got a green grocer, which is obviously
that's
ideal.
That's the best, sure.
Just actually go online and just order, you know, fruit and vegetable, or go to a company like Oddbox where you get a
love
load
that
of brilliant vegetables that are slightly different shapes, but like they're great, they're fresh.
Yes,
you know,
and we need to support our farmers and producers and growers, frankly, you know, because if we don't
buy
support
direct
them,
from them.
Yeah, then they're going to disappear and then we're all stuffed.
So that would be one of my advices. You know, avoid the supermarket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like, coming back to the hormones, I think another hormone that we need to know about, which you touched on earlier, is ghrelin. Now, where does that come into? We've talked a little bit about leptin being very helpful. What about ghrelin? Presumably that's the other side of the coin, is it?
Yeah, so ghrelin is the appetite hormone. And it's a short-term appetite hormone, so it will work over hours or days. And this is the hormone that is produced by the top part of the stomach. We call it the fundus of the stomach. If we haven't eaten for a few hours, the level of ghrelin in our bloodstream starts to rise, and then the hypothalamus senses this and it starts to, you know, give you that feeling of hunger and food seeking behavior and calorie seeking behavior. So bad foods, mm-hmm. you know, and this is the thing that, you know, anyone who's fasted or anyone who's gone on big low calorie diets, ghrelin is the enemy, you know,
right.
It's the thing that, you know, is really, really difficult to resist. You know, the weight loss injections and bariatric surgery tend to block ghrelin, I think indirectly, mm-hmm. but they tend to block it. But, you know, it's really difficult to withstand it, you know.
Powerful.
It's just one of our, you know, it's one of the mechanisms the body uses to keep us at its desired weight, which might not be a healthy weight. Mm. But if you understand why your brain wants to keep you at an unhealthy weight, because, for instance, you've got far too much omega-6 in your bloodstream and around your cells, and, you know, your diet is too full of sugars, carbs, and snacking, then once you sort of get that, then it's easier to sort of understand how to lose weight and keep it off. Once you sort of really understand, you know, what the food does to you as a drug,
mm-hmm.
you know, does your body and your hormones as a drug, and also what it does to you as far as your mind and habits are concerned, once you understand that, it just becomes quite natural that, you know, there are some things you don't want to eat anymore.
Absolutely. You're just not going to go there. I mean, I remember when we had our original conversation on an earlier episode, you talked about all of us having a weight set point, you know, the weight that our body seems to be happiest at. And I think that you're alluding to that here now, you know, that there is a set point, and it may be slightly more than perhaps we would ideally want to see on the scales for ourselves. You know, how far can we fight against that set point? And, you know, is it something that we're literally going to have to live with and say, listen, the body wants to be this weight. You're never going to be less than this, but actually it's going to be quite healthy for you to be that weight.
Yes, the weight set point is, I think, just explains weight regulation, obesity, you know, intractable obesity, people not being able to lose weight on diets. And the theory is that it's a combination of your genetics and your food and stress environment. 75% of the weight set point is actually due to your genetics. So, you know, it might be that you're lucky enough to have a naturally slim body and you can actually eat a load of rubbish and not put weight on. Some people are like that. But actually, probably 2/3 of the population the other way, and that, you know, when they're exposed to a Western food environment, we talk about sugar, refined carbohydrates, snacking, you know, vegetable oils, they will start to put the weight on because, you know, they will start to develop a blockage of this hormonal regulation system, leptin, and, you know, their weight set point will drift upwards. And it's not just, so we got genetics and we got Western food environment, but we've also got stress. So cortisol is very important. So this is where we all sort of know that if you we sort of know, and I have a lot of patients who can't lose weight, you know, despite really low calorie dieting, and they tend to be very, very stressed. They can't stop talking. They've got like problems with, you know, at work or, you know, or in their families. And it's clear that they've got very high levels of stress, and it's almost like they're acting like a, a cornered animal, you know, and a cornered animal is not going to want to get rid of any energy. You know, it needs to keep that energy in case, you know, it needs to go on a long run or whatever. So stress levels are really important to release you. If you want to lose weight, you need to de-stress, because otherwise cortisol is going to keep that weight on.
So how specifically does it do that? How does a higher level of cortisol make you retain a higher level of fat, for example, in the body?
Again, it's due to insulin. So right. It affects insulin signaling. So it's basically all sort of tied up with insulin signaling. So the more cortisol you have, the higher the insulin level. That then blocks the leptin. And it's not just sort of work and family stresses. It's also sleep that's really important.
Yes.
So if you don't sleep properly, you know, naturally you're going to be much more stressed. So it's really important to, you know, have good sleep hygiene. We sort of all know this anyway.
Sure.
But, you know, we need to get our melatonin working. Melatonin is that hormone that comes from our brain when it starts to get dark. And it's released and we naturally become very, very sleepy. We don't want to go through a situation where it's 11 o'clock or 11:30 at night, all the lights are on full.
Yes.
And then you expect to go to sleep straight away. It's impossible.
Well, I've actually recently invested in a pair of blue blocking glasses.
So oh,
I've got really good. And I have a sleep app. And I can track my sleep and monitor the amount of REM and deep sleep that I get. And I know that when I'm wearing my blue light blocking glasses from like 6-7 in the evening, I have a better night's sleep, and I can prove it through tracking it on the app.
And what app do you use, Liz?
I use Sleep Cycle.
Is that just from a watch or?
No, it's just a free app. I mean, I think you can pay to have an upgrade or whatever, but it acts as my alarm, and you switch it off, so it's not on Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or anything at night, because I switch all that off at night too. I'm not quite sure how it works, magic or something, but it records your breathing, and also quite scarily, it records your snoring. So you can actually tell. Yeah, so I'm taping my mouth and doing all of that. But, you know, a lot of the things I'm doing are prioritizing sleep, because I know that that is in turn affecting my hormones and is increasing things like the level of achromantia in the gut, which we know has been linked to staying a healthy weight for longer. And, you know, presumably you're well across kind of microbiome and beneficial bacteria that can also help.
Yeah, well, actually, Liz, I'm quite a pessimist about the microbiome.
Are you?
So I think it might be a bit of an industry.
Oh.
I don't think you can prove anything.
Interesting.
You know, you can sort of prove anything with a lot of loose data, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, investment in this whole area. There's a lot of people selling, you know, probiotics and things like that.
Yes.
I'm sure it will come to something, but at the moment, I think there's quite a lot of BS with the research there.
For instance,
you can't prove that someone's who's obese and whose microbiome is different is obese because of that microbiome. You know, food causes a change in the microbiome.
Okay, which came first? Was it the microbiome or the food?
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's going to be a point for another podcast, I think. But basically, bottom line, as we kind of wrap up here, I think there are some incredibly helpful takeaways here. Bottom line is chuck out the seed oils, the ultra processed foods, the refined sugars, the carbs. Look at things like fructose and, you know, all those high sugar foods. Prioritize sleep. Try and keep stress levels down. And reframe your brain. Reframe the way that you think about things, get into these healthier habits, start to, you know, lift the veil on the food industry and not buy into it, not be one of their pawns on the chessboard.
And you know what you got to do as well, which is in the book, make it easy to cook great food. So sort out your kitchen. And this is explained in one of the chapters of the book.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a chef myself, but, you know, as an enthusiastic amateur, it's like some advice about, you know, what to have in, where, you know, what should be in your pantry, you know, all this stuff that should just be ready to cook. All you need is a few fresh ingredients. You can knock up anything. And then the book's actually got some recipes this time around because, you know, people wanted some. And the one that I really love is the mushroom buckwheat risotto. So
nice.
Buckwheat is fantastic as a sort of switch from white rice.
Mm-hmm.
Proteiny, it's a little bit crunchy. It's a lovely taste. So you'd
nice.
Recommend that one.
Do love a bit of buckwheat. I was making buckwheat blinis over the Christmas period.
Cool. Fantastic.
So, and interestingly, for those listening, they are gluten-free because it's actually a seed, isn't it, and not a grain.
It is, and you know, they're a staple in Russia and Eastern Europe, these countries that don't suffer with obesity.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you so much, Andrew. I really, really enjoyed our chat. Very best of luck with the book. It's brilliant, as is your first one, and I'm sure it's given a lot of people a lot of food for thought, if you'll excuse the pun. So thank you.
A pleasure as always, Liz. Thanks.
Well, a huge thanks to Andrew again for all his time. And I was fascinated by that. I mean, so much of it we know, don't we? Eat less sugar, do a little bit of exercise. But that hormonal element is just so crucial. And I thought that the information about seed oils and the explanation there about what these omega-6s are doing in terms of lowering our insulin signaling and just not making us as insulin resistant as we need to be was absolutely fascinating. So no seed oils, no sugar, looking at the omega-3s, a bit more fish, for example. And these are all things that we can do relatively easily that will make a huge difference. And remember, of course, if you are ever in need of some healthy eating inspiration, do head over to lizourwellbeing.com. Lots and lots of delicious recipes on there. I'm loving some of the savory dishes at the moment and also some of the warming soups and interesting winter salads as well. Absolutely delicious and packed with good nutrition. Well, how has your relationship with food changed over time? Do let's carry on this conversation. The best way to do that for us is on Instagram. That's at lizourwellbeing. And if you'd like to chat with me, you can do so in the comments at lizourlme. Well, next week, how to be your own therapist. Really interesting and useful stuff. Join me for that by clicking the follow button wherever you're listening to this right now. And if you can't wait and you'd like to hear that episode and all future episodes 24 hours early without any ads, you can subscribe to the Lizour Wellbeing Show Plus on Apple Podcasts, and that's a very small monthly fee. Okay, well, until the next time we chat, go very well. Goodbye. The Liz Earle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Liz Earle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.